Welcome to Two-Way Street. We have a very special show for you today. It features two recording artists who grew up together in Macon, Georgia, and who've had enormous global success in different genres of music. My guests are Mike Mills and Robert McDuffie. Mike Mills is a founding member of REM. He played bass, keyboards, and guitars, and sang backup vocals to lead singer Michael Stipe. Although the band has always maintained a certain mystery around who wrote the songs, Mills says they were almost always a collective effort that he was deeply involved in. You already know REM's backstory. They began playing together in Athens back in around 1980 and developed a huge following playing in the bars at UGA. But their 1983 debut album, Murmur, expanded their fan base to a national audience. Rolling Stone named Murmur Best Album of the Year, and for the next three decades, REM continued to turn out popular and artistically impressive records until the band members decided to go their separate ways in 2011. That's Robert McDuffie. Over the same years that Mike Mills was becoming a star with REM, McDuffie was becoming an acclaimed soloist featured by orchestras around the world. Of course, he knows the classical repertory, but he's also extended his range beyond symphonic halls. For example, he accompanied Anna Deavere Smith in a moving reading of Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail.
And see tears welling up in her eyes when she's told that Funtown is closed to colored children. And see the ominous clouds of inferiority beginning to form in her little mental sky. And see her beginning to distort her personality with an unconscious bitterness towards white people.
McDuffie has played Bach in a performance featuring juke dancer Little Buck, and he shared stages with rock stars like Greg Allman. But his most famous collaboration may have been with composer Philip Glass. McDuffie approached Glass and suggested he write a contemporary version of Vivaldi's Four Seasons. As if all that weren't enough, McDuffie is the founder of the Rome Music Festival in Italy, where he performs every summer. But he also decided he wanted to do something for his hometown of Macon. And so 9 years ago, McDuffie established the McDuffie Center for Strings at Mercer University. The program has gained acclaim for training fine string students, but at McDuffie's insistence, it also provides a rounded education in liberal arts and business. Our producer, Trevor Young, who McDuffie tells us is a very talented bass player, is a graduate of that program. McDuffie and Mills joined us in the Two-Way Street studio to talk about their lives and work and their new collaboration. Robert McDuffie and Mike Mills, thank you so much for being here for Two-Way Street.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about the collaboration that you're involved with right now, but I really think it's really important to point out that you go back all the way to childhood in Macon, Georgia, right, Mike?
This is true. This is true. When we left Atlanta in 1971 to move to Macon, my parents wanted to find a church because that was a great musical outlet. So they wanted to find the best musical church in Macon. And the one they picked, First Presbyterian, the choir was run by a woman named Susan McDuffie. And so we would go there and spend all day Sunday doing churchy things and musical things. And as we got to know the McDuffies, we would just go over to their house every Sunday night for Apri Church.
Now, Susan McDuffie was
my mother. Mom was the organist and choir director, and Mike's dad was the tenor soloist, and his mother, Adora, sang in the alto section.
Correct.
And in Macon, and many places in Georgia, you're in church pretty much all day on Sunday.
Yeah.
And so we had the morning service and the evening service and then choir handbell stuff, youth group meetings before beforehand. And Mike and I met, we were 12. Pretty sure we were 12.
Mm-hmm. That's
and
correct.
We're the same age. I'm a little older. And
always will be.
yeah. But at the end of Sunday night service, the two families would go back to the McDuffie house, yeah. and my dad would have Bloody Marys ready for yeah. everybody except us. And they, who knows what they did, and we just had a good time, the McDuffie kids and the Mills kids, and listened to records and watched Sunday night TV shows and exchanged Hardy Boys books, you know, all that kind of stuff. Wow. Mike was, I will say, Mike, you know, Mike is this very cool rock star, as you know.
Yes.
I will say he was not a cool rock star growing up in Macon.
What does that mean? What was he? How would you describe Mike?
Earnest. Incredibly earnest kid who was very curious.
Are you mad because I said you were older than me?
Yeah. I mean...
I was pretty nerdy.
No, I think Ernest. You were just very curious. You were just very interested in everything.
Yeah.
Okay. Always asking questions. And,
true.
You wouldn't shut up.
Okay. Being from Macon, you both were exposed to some remarkable Georgia artists growing up, right, Mike?
Well, the thing about growing up in the South and in Georgia in particular is the diversity of music to which you get exposed. Of course, there's Top 40 on the radio, which was sort of my guiding light. But there's country everywhere that you turn. There's white gospel and black gospel. In Macon, the blues were considered an art form, so you got to hear plenty of that. My dad listened to a lot of jazz music and classical music, so I went to sleep hearing, you know, either the Four Freshmen or Franco Corelli and other tenors sing the high C, all of which was great, and all of which seeped into my consciousness and rattled around in there for about 30 years.
Yeah, and who were some of the musicians, the artists that you were really paying attention to? Some of the same, I assume, right?
Right.
Bobby?
I was obsessed with the Edith Peach and Fillmore East albums, the Allman Brothers. Yeah. I mean, I went to, I mean, I was living in North Macon, so my parents wouldn't let me go down to, you know, to Grant's Lounge or any of the other fun places in downtown. But I was proud that the Allman Brothers were living in Macon, even though I was only 13, 14. But I wore Edith Peach out, Fillmore East, and also, mm-hmm. without sounding too obsequious here, Frank Mills singing My Soul Doth Magnify from
really?
The Saint-Saëns Christmas Oratorio.
Really?
I wore that cassette out.
Yeah,
that guy made a record. Was pretty amazing.
Am I right? You mentioned the Allman Brothers. Am I right that there's an Allman Brothers album that the cover of which they're posed in front of the building that is now the building that houses your string program?
You are correct.
That's pretty cool. It's We're going to talk about that more specifically later, but
right.
what an interesting connection.
Maybe
for
you can
you.
Get the on your website. Maybe you can get the juxtaposition, because we redid the pose. We some students, you know, we tried to look as gnarly as we could in front of the columns, but it was their debut album.
We will do that on the two-way street at gpb.org/TWS. We will find both of those pictures and put them up for our listeners. So you're both musicians. You started playing the violin at a really early age, right?
I was six. In Macon, we had two Hungarian brothers who showed up and to teach in the Bibb County school system. And I studied with one for about a year and a half. He passed away, and I must say I was really happy because I hated to practice. My mother made me practice, and I was, you know, 7 years old. And I was just like wishing that he would die, and then one day he was gone.
He did.
When my mother told me, I was just a little. My heart jumped a little bit, and then I got really sad. And he had a brother who was my main teacher. He taught me for about 8 years.
Yeah.
Prisoner of war was Suharto's private violinist in Indonesia, taught the Suharto children, and when the coup happened, he fled. The only opening in America was in Bibb County that his brother found for him. And and he taught me privately until I was 16 when I left Macon.
And you knew. You left Macon to go to Juilliard.
Correct.
So you knew.
My mother knew. My mother knew. I mean, once people started clapping for me at the Rotary Clubs, I thought maybe this might be interesting. But I really did hate to I did not enjoy practicing. But it was when I was 14 and Itzhak Perlman came to Macon to play. I was on the basketball team at FPD High School in Macon, and I was not very good in basketball, but I had worked really hard, and the coach was going to have me start. And we were playing a rival school, and that was the night that Perlman came to Macon. I'd never heard of him. That's the last thing I wanted to do. I was hating practice. I'd already been playing for 8 years, and my parents made me go to hear him, and I was furious, made them sit in the back. This was at Wesleyan College. They made them sit in the back of the auditorium. I sat on the front row, fuming. And it was one of those major nights, you know, that you can count on one hand. First of all, it was the first time I ever felt empathy for anybody because he's handicapped. And yeah. it was a real struggle for him to get on stage. And I'm glad I had that gene. And but the minute he started to play, I didn't give a damn about basketball anymore.
Do you remember to this day what he played?
Exactly. He started with the Devil's Trill of Tartini. He played Brahms Sonata. He played several Paganini Caprices. He played the Round of the Goblins. And I just did not, it was just the joy of music making that got me. It was like a bird singing on a tree. It was so natural. I mean, I knew how hard the violin was, but I saw him do things effortlessly. And I did not care about basketball. I just went home and practiced, you know, until 5-6 in the morning.
You have undoubtedly played some of those pieces over the years. Do you think about Perlman when you play those pieces?
I do. I think about him all the time. We're in a poker group.
Really?
Yeah, we've been in a poker group for 25 years.
Is he any good?
He's terrible, but I'm worse.
All right. Mike, you had an interesting musical journey, too. You started playing the tuba and sousaphone in the high school. Martha, what high school?
Northeast High School.
And you were...
Mighty Raiders.
Okay, you were in the marching band?
Yeah, I started taking piano lessons from a music student at Wesleyan College named Earlene Gammel. I'll never forget her name. Hello, Earlene, wherever you are. Thank you for starting me off. And then switched over to my friend Susie Anderson. Susie and Fletcher were dear friends of my family, and I babysat their kids, and she taught me piano in exchange for that. And then I got my mother's friend, who was a psychiatrist, who also played bass guitar, a woman, to loan me her basses. So I started teaching myself bass, and my mom had a guitar. I started teaching myself that. And then around 10th grade, got to college, and in order to play bass in the jazz band, which is what I really wanted, you had to also play tuba in the concert band and sousaphone in the marching band. So I learned those things, and by the fact that I was the only one that had any training at all, became first chair in those things, which just shows you how bad we were at poor old Northeast High School. But that's
what was your favorite piece in the jazz band, remember?
Yeah, Hurt So Bad.
Really?
It had just this really cool, it was a great song, and it had a really rocking bass line. And, you know, we were kind of a mellow jazz band, but that was the most fun song to play.
Yeah. And, Bobby, you go off to Juilliard.
Right.
And before you graduated from high school, is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So you were like...
16.
16, you said that. And Mike, you stayed on in Macon and finished high school there, correct?
I did.
Did you stay in touch at that point?
Not really. I think it was mostly our mother's...
it was my mother bragging on me. And sorry, Mom. And it was Mike's mother listening to my mother brag on me. And then, you know, and then later when Mike, you know... sold 90 million albums, the tables turned.
I was just glad to give my mom something to talk about.
Oh,
was...
man. Just like, yeah.
You know, that's an... Okay, so let's talk a little about that. And about your journeys to become what you each became in your careers. Mike, your what was the first band that you played in right after you... Beyond the jazz band?
Oh, well, yeah. We had a band called Shadowfax with Bill Berry, who went on to play in REM, and my friend David Clark, who was basically sort of a reborn Dwayne Allman. He knew everything about Dwayne Allman. He had the autopsy reports from his motorcycle accident. I mean, he was basically trying to live as Dwayne Allman. And he could play guitar like Dwayne Allman pretty well, too. And so the fun thing about being in a band in Macon is you could play... at the sock hops that we played, you could play half your set would be top 40, and the other half could be the blues, because Macon understood that, and there aren't many cities where you could get away with that. So Shadowfax used to play around and have a good time. And
playing a lot of covers?
Oh, yeah, they were almost all covers. I mean, we weren't writing songs at that point. I think we had one that was ours.
Yeah, yeah. So covering everything, what were you covering?
Well, let's see, ZZ Top, Bad Company. Of course, I think every band... has to play Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo when you're growing up. It's de rigueur. And, you know, just fun things like that. And then we'd mix in John Hammond and Muddy Waters and whatever other blues we felt like playing.
When did you first tour? What band were you with when you really started?
Oh, that was R.E.M.
It was R.E.M.
Yeah, the band from Macon.
81?
We probably started playing in 80. I'd say
okay.
We started playing in 80. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. And you were traveling in a bus, I assume.
No, we had Bill Berry's Ford LTD. We pulled a Jartran trailer behind that until our sound man wrecked the car. And then pretty soon we realized we had to get a van, so we bought an old Dodge Ram that had shag carpeting and wood-burned trays on the inside. It was totally decked out.
And where were you? Where were you touring? Where were you in the early days?
North Carolina basically kept us alive. You could go. We worked. Most of us worked. So on the weekends, we could go to play three shows in Chapel Hill, Raleigh, Winston-Salem, Charlotte. And then there was another weekend trip we could make where you'd go up and you'd play Nashville and Memphis and come back. And those weekend trips would pay our rent and food and everything for the month.
Bobby, what was happening in your career? Were you still at Juilliard when they first got on the radar?
I was at Juilliard through 81.
And when you started going out as a violinist, how did your career begin post-Juilliard?
Slowly. And I'm looking back, I'm really happy that it wasn't an overnight kind of thing. I played in the New York Philharmonic my senior year of college to pay the rent. I was last chair, second violin. I mean, I was so far back, I was behind the percussion. but learned a lot about rhythm. And still, I played in the Juilliard Orchestra. I would do some gigs on Broadway in the pit.
Really?
I remember a run of Porgy and Bess that we had. I'd play in freelance orchestras around town, Baroque orchestras, just any pickup orchestra. But I was pretty ambitious, and I saw myself eventually being a soloist. I felt that's what I wanted to be.
So here's what you've been quoted as saying. I went out and paid my dues in my 20s, playing in every small town in America, learning how to be on stage, to be on tour, learning how to speak from the stage. So I'm wondering, as I read that about you, how similar would the experiences of a guy playing with a rock and roll band and an artist playing largely symphonic music, how similar are your touring experiences?
Well, when you read that quote, I said that sounds exactly right. I mean, because we played, when we started, there was no circuit like there is now. We and a few other bands created this small circuit of places you could play, and we played anywhere that would have us. We were often, New Wave Night at the gay bars or at biker bars, and pizza joints and anywhere that guy would put up a small PA and clear the dance floor. So.
Okay, so you're touring, though, in a van. How does a symphonic artist?
Well, then I started, after I left school and I left the orchestra, playing in the orchestra world, I did sign with a management, Columbia mm-hmm. Artist, and they had a kind of an apprentice-like program where they sent their artists around the country and small towns. I did hundreds of those, combined with residencies sponsored by a group called Affiliate Artist, where we would go into a small town like Ottumwa, Iowa. I would go there for 7 weeks, sponsored by John Deere. I'd play in jails and in fire stations and in schools and in shopping malls. And at the end of the residency, I'd play a real concerto. But it was in those, they called them informal performances, where I would play these pieces that I'd heard Perlman play when I was 14, and then talk about my life. And that went on for about 4 to 5 years, the combination of playing in 48 states over those first five years.
That is a heck of an apprenticeship. That's amazing.
Right. This we would go into a community and work with the main company in town, Monsanto. In Springfield, Massachusetts, even though I think they're St. Louis-based, but they had a big presence in Springfield. Delta in Fort Myers, Florida, they asked me to perform in the baggage claim area. And then they asked me if I would mind riding in on the conveyor belt. playing Bach.
No.
Yeah,
that's not
they
true.
Did ask me. That is true.
Oh my gosh.
Artists don't lie.
Mike, it sounds in a way as though Bobby may have had it a little tougher than even you do. I mean, we think about the stories of bands
I'm sure
starting
you have.
Up.
Oh, I can only imagine what Mike.
Well, I mean, I always wanted to ride on one of those conveyor belts, but never
I did.
Got the
I declined.
Chance.
I don't think this is why my mother wanted me to go to Juilliard to play behind an oversized bag.
We're going to take a break now, but when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Robert McDuffie and Mike Mills. This is Two Way Street. Welcome back to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. If you're just joining us, my guests today are Mike Mills, one of the founders of REM, and Robert McDuffie, a world-acclaimed violinist. Now, at McDuffie's suggestion, Mills has written a concerto for violin and rock orchestra that they're on tour performing. But before we get to that, we're going to talk a little more about how they watched each other from a distance rise to stardom.
When Mike first played in New York, he did give me a call. Bobby, I'm in a band.
we're playing at the Mud Club.
Yeah, we're playing somewhere at 3 in the morning, and it's called REM, and it's so exciting, and can you come? And I had a class. I had a class at, I think, 9 o'clock the next morning, 8:30 the next morning, and I was like, God, I wish I could go. And I remember talking, trying to impress a girl to go to the club to see you, and she turned me down, and I got sleepy.
Ooh.
And but of course, I was hearing about him and listening to him and saw you on Letterman and so proud walking through LaGuardia one day and seeing his band on the cover of Rolling Stone, America's greatest rock band. Holy sh!
When would that have been? Do you remember when that first cover was?
86, maybe, okay. Something like that. 86, 87.
I want to play a little bit of the music that each of you has done separately. Bobby, you've talked about the collaboration with Philip Glass on the American version of Vivaldi's Four Seasons. One of the fun stories about that is you, although Vivaldi knew what the seasons were, you two couldn't agree on what
no,
the seasons
were. No, we disagreed on every season. His winter was my summer.
But I think to broader audiences, this is the most well-known piece of yours. Is that a fair thing to say to the broadest audiences out there?
Yes, I think so, because it was original and it sold more.
Sold a lot.
Sold more than my other book. But saying that in front of Mike, it's just a different world.
It's all relative.
But it's all relative. But yes, it has sold more. Recordings than my others.
So yeah. Let's listen to just a little bit of the, it's concerto number two.
It's his second violin concerto.
Second violin concerto. Philip Glass and Robert McDuffie. Robert McDuffie, that is just mesmerizingly beautiful.
Well, that's his music. I mean, I just try not to get in the way.
Your playing's not shabby.
Well,
no, it's not.
Mike, people are always trying to ask you what your favorite REM song is. And I think you told Time magazine that if you really were forced to do it, Man on the Moon might be the song you choose or the most representative of your music. Is that fair?
It's probably one of the most fully realized and it combines, I think, all the great elements of REM. There's a sense of humor. It's got power. It's moving. You know, it gets you in the heart and the head and the hips at the same time.
Why don't we listen to a bit of REM's Man on the Moon? And
Andy, are you goofing on Elvis too? Are we losing touch?
That's just a little bit of REM's Man on the Moon. Okay, so what I'd really like to do now to bring your career arcs together is to talk about the story of your violin, Bobby, because it's really a wonderful story, and it did bring you two together in a different way. What violin do you play?
I play a Guarnerius del Gesù. Joseph Guarnerius worked at the same time as Stradivarius in Cremona, Italy, a northern Italian town known for its violin-making acumen. Guarnerius was not as famous as Stradivarius. I think Stradivarius had a better publicist at the at the time. But Stradivarius was very famous when they were living. Guarnerius made violins that were played in pit orchestras and a lot of plucking of the strings, pizzicato in operas, and so their nails would scratch the varnish. And I mean, they weren't well, and they were slightly crudely made. The F holes on the Guarneri violins are not as pristine as the Strads. And it wasn't until after he died that people started realizing, oh my Lord, these violins by Guarnerius are canons.
Why?
I mean, well, that's the question. Nobody really
Well, what
knows,
I mean by that is, what are the tones that you produce with that violin?
The best Guarneri violins carry over an orchestra, just sound-wise. They're just powerful and rich, and that's why most soloists prefer the Guarneris over the Stradivaris. And there are a couple of soloists who play Strads, and there are one or two loud Stradivaris in the world. But Guarnerius made these violins that just had such punch and beauty, dark, deep beauty. And the violin that I play now has qualities of both Stradivari and Guarneri. It has beauty at the top and richness at the bottom, and it carries over an orchestra.
I think I'm right that you found this violin in like 2001, around there.
Well, I found it in the mid-90s.
Okay, but you moved to a place where you wanted it to be yours in around 2001. Is that correct?
Right. Well, I was looking and begging for help. I mean, I was pretty, maybe obnoxious. I mean, I really thought that when I found out what the price was, which was $3.5 million in the 90s, that I would just be able to tap into the Georgia, you know, we're so proud of you, Bobby thing, and and you know, go to a bank in Georgia. And so I went to one bank here, SunTrust, and went to Jimmy Williams, the famous banker.
Sure,
he knows about the story, so I'm not, you know, I'm not divulging private information. But I asked him to invest in the future of classical music and buy a $3.5 million violin. And he said, well, why do you have to play a $3 million violin? Why can't you play a $1 million violin?
That's why he was such a successful banker.
That's right. I said, well, playing on a $1 million violin is like running with a pulled hamstring.
Oh.
He went, ooh, that's a good analogy. That is such a good analogy. We're not saying no. However, they eventually said no, but I did get my parking ticket validated. So that was some success out of that meeting.
So, you needed to raise $3.5 million, and this is where you entered the story. And before you talk about how you helped, were part of the team, really, that helped Bobby, could you relate to his story about finding exactly the right instrument?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Tell it from your point of view.
Well, I mean, the electronic instruments and fretted instruments are so much less fine, than a fretless instrument like a violin. Nonetheless, they are personal. And I've found a couple over the years that you know, it's just one of those things that when you play it, and sometimes you don't even really have to hear it. It's just the playing of it that lets you know that that's the one you need.
Do you play a guitar that means maybe almost as much to you as this particular violin means to Bobby?
I have two basses that I would be very devastated if I were to lose either of them. Yeah.
Because?
Because they would be irreplaceable, number one, and what I've been through with them, number two. I mean, I have the Rickenbacker that I started playing in the very early 80s that I played for many years until the pickup went bad. And then in 89, I bought a Fender Precision that I used for 89 and 95 and every subsequent tour after that. So I have two basses that have traveled this journey with me, and they both served me well, and I feel like they're people, and I would really be really sad if something happened to them.
So you kind of understood.
Oh, absolutely, I understood.
And how did you two get together? You needed to create a group of investors to invest, not in a violin, in you.
Well, after several false starts, I mean, SunTrust didn't work out. I talked to a couple of other people, Nations Bank that was around at the time, and someone had suggested the idea of a limited partnership where we would sell shares in the violin, and it would kind of following an aircraft lease model, but mm-hmm. whiting out aircraft and putting in violin and then putting in a morals clause for me. I don't know why they would do that, but they did. But Mike and I had reconnected in the meantime. I know he came backstage when I played with the Atlanta Symphony back in the late 80s, and we were in Kansas City at the same time, not long after that. R.E.M. was playing at the big Kemper Arena, and I was playing with the Kansas City Symphony. And we'd gotten tickets to the R.E.M. show, and I never played so fast in all of my life just to get it over with. And my wife and I were there. My wife had come to the concert as well. So I played fast, refused to play an encore, get in a taxi, go straight to Kemper, and that's when I saw Mike live for the first time. And it was insane.
What does that mean?
I mean, I knew, but I didn't know. I mean, it was 18,000 people screaming, but singing every word to their music. And it was magnificent. The optics, obviously, were great, but it was tight ensemble music making. There was chamber music going on. There was raw energy and great artistry.
Did you know he was there that night?
Yeah, I believe I did. It made me happy.
Yeah.
I probably played even better.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you must have had great pride in him.
Oh,
and
I really didn't get it until I saw him in Kansas City.
All right, so, but let's go back to the violin story. You became one of the investors.
Yeah, I went, they had a meeting in Atlanta at some rich person's house in Buckhead, and I went along, and I was, I was happy. I was already planning to do it because I thought it would be a fun investment, but mostly I wanted to be a part of Bobby's ride going forward. Because I mean, I knew he was great in 1974, but to see everything he'd accomplished and to just to be a part of my friend's musical world going forward was a very attractive thing to me. So I was happy to jump in.
I think you have said, and I'm not quoting you directly, but that acquiring this violin in many ways really allowed your career to take off. Is that correct? Am I right about that?
It did, but that was a byproduct of just becoming, I think, a more sincere artist.
Sure.
Because I was able to use an instrument that where I could truly speak without reservation.
Yeah.
I can put it in fifth gear and just go and do what I want to do musically without feeling like I'm running with a pulled hamstring. Okay. And I just felt that I could express who I am as a musician with this instrument.
It's really extraordinary that you two guys who knew each other when you were children end up having a partnership around the instrument that you have taken around the world. That's kind of thrilling.
It's wonderful. It's a pretty rare story.
My guests today are Mike Mills, a founder of R.E.M., and Robert McDuffie, an acclaimed violin soloist. We're going to take a break now, but when we come back, we're going to listen to a little of the concerto that Mills wrote for McDuffie. Thank you.
Let's get back to my conversation with Mike Mills and Robert McDuffie. Boyhood friends who've achieved enormous success in their separate musical pursuits and who've now collaborated on a new composition McDuffie asked Mills to write. It's a concerto for violin, rock band, and string orchestra. Mike, you've written your first piece for a symphonic orchestra. Tell us about it.
Well, Bobby came to me a couple of years ago and asked if I would write this concerto for violin and rock band, and I was at a point in my life where I had to figure out, am I just going to coast through or am I going to extend myself? So I decided to, you know, jump off the cliff.
Yeah, by now, REM, you had all REM's decided over. To go your own way, separate ways, and happily, so, fortunately.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, all good-natured there. So I just said, okay, I'll try this thing. And let me preface this by saying that what we realized after we started working on this, what we realized that we want to try to do is break down the walls between classical music and rock and roll music, and break down the walls between performer and audience. If we can knock as many of those down as we can, then we will have done our job. What we're finding is that the Venn diagram between classical and rock can merge, and they can actually be a part of each other's worlds. So when I was writing this piece, I really just saw it as six different songs, but I had to think of it in terms of a violin instead of a vocalist being the lead instrument. So that was really, it wasn't all that different from writing other kinds of music, except that I had to think in those terms, and then once I'd written it, I had to work really hard with the arranger, David Malamud, who's done just an amazing job on this concerto, to combine the rock band with the string orchestra. And so there's all this merging of different things that have to come together smoothly to make the whole thing work.
I'm always intrigued by the process of writing music, especially symphonic music, because I'm not quite sure the thought process. When you set out to write this concerto, are you thinking about a story you want to tell? Are you thinking about musical themes that move you in some way? What's the start of that process?
Well, you have to. What I think of is, I try to put together some chords that feel fresh, you know, that are not just standard, ordinary chord progressions, if I can. And then comes the most important part, which is the melody. And it's what I've always loved about making music from the very beginning of any time I started playing an instrument, melody. Melody is the number one thing for me. So what I had to do was make sure that each of these songs had as many great melodies as possible, and certainly at least one that would grab you and be a theme and be a reason for this piece to exist.
Okay. Bobby, it's interesting. Mike said something I thought that was important, trying to break down the walls between musicians, especially in symphonic music, and an audience. This is a struggle that in your world, orchestras go through all the time. How do we engage an audience, a new audience particularly? I mean, this is a great challenge in your world, isn't it?
It has been going on for a while. I mean, there's so many systemic issues there. I mean, I personally believe the American Symphony model is broken, but that's another conversation. I think if people really worked seriously on this and give musicians more of a voice, things might be a little better.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's another conversation. But you're right. It is about putting fannies in the seats and getting them away from their electronic devices and coming in for an amazing, memorable live experience.
So aside from the fact that you have obviously respect for Mike's work as an artist, you also recognize having someone from REM write a piece of music it could really open the door for people
listen. I didn't just fall off the turnip truck. and it was that thinking when I went to Philip Glass as well, another one of America's great composers. And I'm really not being hyperbolic. I think Mike is one of America's greatest composers. But because it was Philip and his profile and his popularity, I didn't just want to learn a new piece just for the sake of learning a piece and putting it on the shelf. I wanted it to have legs. And that was my thinking as well with Mike, knowing that he had the talent. And of course, we had our history, and it certainly didn't hurt that he had some name recognition.
Yeah. Did you two come together as you were writing? Did you share pieces of this as you were putting them together? Did you offer feedback, or did you just present it to him whole one day?
No, I kept Bobby in the loop as I felt like I had something worth showing or listening to. But no, Bobby was encouraging without trying to nudge me in any particular direction. He was very open to whatever I wanted to do. And like I said, just very encouraging, which was good because it's a daunting thing and I was not at all sure I could pull it off.
So you're now, you have a tour of this piece going on right now.
Yeah. Oh, we've already done it three times.
Yeah.
We played it with the Toronto Symphony in a full symphonic version, played it in Rome, a chamber music acoustic version.
Where you have your own music festival every year.
Right, and Mike was our star attraction this summer. And we just played it in Aspen with conservatory level students leaning in.
I know you haven't been in the studio to record the concerto yet, but we do have a version of it that you did with students at the McDuffie program in Macon. So let's just listen to it. This was in an early stage, I think, and this was with your string players, including our own Trevor Young.
Yes, Trevor was in the band.
So
that's the part you were talking about, right?
Yeah, now I kind of like it.
Yeah. Share this, please. What are we saying? Well, two were starting to have a little conversation as you were listening. What's he talking about, Mike?
This sort of music, it can be revised at any time. I don't know if it will ever get to a point where we see it's completely finished. It'll never change a note. As you play things, as you listen to them, as you play them for audiences, you may find a place that you can improve. And Bobby and I were having a discussion about one of the parts of that last movement that we may or may not adjust.
So, with the few minutes we have remaining, tell me what it's like to work together. You, childhood friends, you've gone your separate ways, both had incredibly successful careers. And here you are back together again more than 30-plus years later.
Yeah. Well, once I started seeing Bobby play again after some years of not seeing him, I told the rest of my band, I said, that guy's got more talent in his little finger than we have collectively. And, just the amount of work that goes into what Bobby does is that's why we're in rock and roll, because we're incapable of working that hard. So it's a joy to be able to watch him play. It's an honor to think that he would want my music to be the music that he plays. It's once we got going, I realized that this is something bigger than what I think maybe Bobby was already aware of it, but I certainly wasn't aware of what this can do, which is, as I say, we're trying to, it's a kind of a new genre of music in a way. I don't think anybody's ever really attempted to, there have been a lot of blendings of the Philharmonic Orchestra doing, Metallica's music or R.E.M.'s music or something like that. But there's never, to my knowledge, really been a piece put together from the ground up for a rock band and a string section and a violin as the lead instrument. So we kind of got a tiger by the tail here. And if we do it right, we can really branch out into, or we can show people that there are just, they're not that distinct. They don't have to be that distinct. If you come to the concert, you don't have to sit there with your hands under your butt. You can applaud at any time. You can, if Bobby rips off some beautiful notes in the middle of a piece, you can cheer. You can applaud in between movements. We're here for everybody to have a good time and enjoy the music and be moved by the power of two different genres coming together at one time.
And to be back with your old friend.
And to be playing with my dear old friend is a true treat. Yes, it is.
Bobby?
Ditto. Why, just back to the music point, why would we want to punish an audience? I mean, we just played a couple of weeks ago in Aspen, which is kind of a staid, wonderful music festival, but there's a certain age there, and I didn't know what to expect, but the minute we walked on stage, it turned into a rock venue, and there were a lot of young people as well, but there were middle-aged people dancing, screaming, yelling. I didn't know. I didn't know it would be like that. It was exciting.
Yeah, I mean, it was like a rock show. It was like a jazz concert in that when you know, Bobby would play some particularly amazing hot riff, people would woo and yell. And yeah. I mean, I didn't expect that. And it was very rewarding. We're getting through, which is great.
The only thing, and I will do this, I've got to do this on one of the shows. I just didn't go, thank you, Aspen. Okay, I'm going to. That's something I've always wanted to do as a classical musician.
That's the real reason. That's the whole reason.
You know, I do want, okay, that's a great thing to point out. The joy I would think for you in a piece like this, and you don't get to do that very often.
No, because you have to adhere to stylistic requirements that not only from the composer, but from tradition. And there's something noble there. But this, I feel like I have playing here. I got a little bit of it in the glass in the American Four Seasons, but I feel free. I was embarrassed because I saw a video clip, and oh my God, I couldn't stop. I mean, moving. I was moving all over the place and, you know, walking across the stage. I mean, it's just like I've been trying to break out for a long time. Thanks to Mike. Thank you.
And you, your idea.
Robert McDuffie and Mike Mills are on tour playing the concerto for violin, rock band, and string orchestra. They'll perform it in Athens at Hodgson Hall on Monday, October 25th, and then we'll be in Atlanta at Emory University's Schwartz Center for the Performing Arts on October 28th. We've posted information about those concerts and the rest of the touring schedule on our website at gpb.org/TWS and on our Facebook page. If you can't make it to one of the concerts, the recording of the concerto will be released in mid-October. As we finish up our segment with Bobby McDuffie and Mike Mills, let's listen to how the concerto sounded at the Aspen Music Festival when Bobby McDuffie was on violin, Mike Mills played with a rock band, and there was a full string orchestra rounding out the piece. Before we leave you today, I want to pay a personal tribute to another exceptional performing artist, Steve Goodman. Next Tuesday marks the anniversary of Steve's death at age 36 on September 20th, 1984. Steve grew up one suburb away from me on Chicago's North Side. He was a Park Ridge kid and I was a Skokie boy. I used to see him perform at a folk club called It's Here that was open to teenagers. Steve went on to work regularly at the other important Chicago folk clubs back in the day, the Earl of Old Town, the Quiet Night, and others. Those clubs also launched the careers of John Prine, Roger McGinn of the Byrds, and Bob Gibson. Steve never became a household name in the music industry, but he wrote and recorded a number of beloved songs and was one of the most sought-after session musicians in Nashville and L.A. He was diagnosed with leukemia in college, and it plagued him throughout his years as a performer. He was a great talent and a wonderful guy, and I think about him every year at this time. And if you don't know him by name, You sure know the song he wrote that became one of the most iconic songs in American music.
And it's penny a point, there ain't no one keeping score. Won't you pass that paper bag that holds that bottle? You can feel the wheels grumbling through the floor. And the sons of Pullman boarders, the sons of engineers, they ride their father's magic carpet made of steam.
That's all the time we have for this week's show. Trevor Young's not only a talented bass player, he's also our talented producer. And Jenny Amontz, our amazing senior producer. I'm Bill Nigut. See you again next week for another Two-Way Street.
America, how are you? Say you know, you know me. I'm your native son. And I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when day's done.